Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, September 4th, 2025, we talk about obesity, type 1 diabetes, syphilis, and heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. A review article on the management of acute type B aortic dissection, a clinical problem solving describing a fruitful workup, and perspectives on the corporatization deal, on advancing physician-scientist training in China, and on the rise of drug innovation in China. Once monthly, maridebart cafraglutide for the treatment of obesity, a phase 2 trial, by Anya Yastreboff from Yale School of Medicine, New Haven, Connecticut, and co-authors. Maridebart cafraglutide is a long-acting peptide antibody conjugate that combines glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonism and glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide receptor antagonism. It is intended for the treatment of obesity. This phase 2 trial included 11 groups as two cohorts. 592 participants with obesity and with or without type 2 diabetes were randomly assigned to receive maridebart cafraglutide subcutaneously at a range of doses once monthly or even less frequently, or placebo. Participants with obesity without type 2 diabetes had a mean weight reduction of up to 16.2% at 52 weeks without reaching a weight plateau. Participants with obesity and type 2 diabetes had a mean weight reduction of up to 12.3%, accompanied by a mean reduction in the glycated hemoglobin level of up to 1.6 percentage points. Gastrointestinal adverse events were common with maridebart cafraglutide, although less frequent in participants who received a gradual dose escalation and a lower starting dose. Editorialist Maria Colazzo Clavel from the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, Rochester, Minnesota, writes that maridebart cafraglutide appears to be efficacious at promoting weight loss and improving hyperglycemia. Patients with type 2 diabetes had less weight loss than those without diabetes, a known but poorly understood observed phenomenon. Although monthly drug administration is attractive, weekly preparations are already seemingly accepted with good adherence and with apparently minimal side effects. The editorialist notes that her enthusiasm for progress in this field is tempered by factors outside of medicine, factors that her medical degree make her ill-equipped to manage. Yet these factors represent the most common barrier to access and long-term adherence to these medications, costs, and coverage. Diabetes and obesity are common threats to our health and longevity, but are not viewed equally. Consider that different preparations of the same medication are marketed separately for diabetes and obesity. Complex factors must be conquered if we are to realize the potential that these medications offer to the millions of persons with obesity and its complications. Stem cell-derived, fully differentiated islets for type 1 diabetes, by Trevor Reichman from the Toronto General Hospital and co-authors. Pluripotent stem cells can be differentiated into therapeutic cells that may be able to replace damaged or destroyed cells during disease. Studies in preclinical models have shown that stem cells can be differentiated into insulin-expressing beta cells and glucagon-expressing alpha cells capable of reversing diabetes. Using an approach that is based on that discovery, these investigators developed zimislecel, a treatment composed of allogeneic stem cell-derived, fully differentiated islets. This phase 1-2 study evaluated the effects of a single infusion of zimislecel in 14 persons with type 1 diabetes with recurrent severe hypoglycemic events and impaired awareness of hypoglycemia, despite appropriate disease management. The results of this small, short-term study supported the hypothesis that zimislecel could restore physiologic islet function in persons with type 1 diabetes. Further clinical investigation is warranted. Survival of transplanted allogeneic beta cells with no immunosuppression by Per-Ola Carlson from Uppsala University, Sweden, and co-authors. The need to suppress a patient's immune system after the transplantation of allogeneic cells is associated with wide-ranging side effects. These investigators report the outcomes of transplantation of genetically modified allogeneic donor islet cells into a man with long-standing type 1 diabetes. The investigators used CRISPR-CRISPR-associated protein 12B, Cas12b editing, and lentivirus transduction to genetically edit the cells to avoid rejection. The cells were then transplanted into the participant's forearm muscle. He did not receive any immunosuppressive drugs, and at 12 weeks after transplantation, showed no immune response against the gene-edited cells. C-peptide measurements showed stable and glucose-responsive insulin secretion. A total of 4 adverse events occurred, none of which were serious or related to the study drug. In a Science Behind the Study article, Kevin Harrell and Jordan Pober from Yale University, New Haven, Connecticut, note that the studies by Reichman and co-authors and Carlson and co-authors are encouraging but preliminary. Additional and careful follow-up is essential to establish long-term efficacy and safety. The potential clinical benefits are substantial. Reichman et al. Found that severe hypoglycemia was prevented in participants who received the full dose of zimislecel, a potentially limitless source of islets. In the report by Reichman, an experience with hypoimmune islets was with a single participant who received less than 10% of the number of islets that would be needed for insulin independence. In this case, the methods of islet isolation and preparation are limiting. The genetic engineering used by Carlson et al. Could be applied to stem cells to obviate the need for immune suppression. An alternative future strategy to prevent transplant allo rejection would be to use islet organoids obtained from induced pluripotent stem cells derived from each patient. One dose versus 3 doses of benzathine penicillin G in early syphilis by Edward Hook III from the University of Alabama at Birmingham and co-authors. Controversy persists regarding the appropriate duration of therapy with benzathine penicillin G in persons with early, that is, primary, secondary, or early latent syphilis, treponema pallidum infection. In this trial, 249 patients who had early syphilis with or without HIV infection were randomly assigned to receive intramuscular injections of benzathine penicillin G in a one-time dose of 2.4 million units or in doses of 2.4 million units administered at 3 successive weekly intervals. 97% of the participants were men. 62% of the participants were Black, and 64% were living with HIV infection. The data from this study show that in participants with uncomplicated early syphilis, a single treatment with benzathine penicillin G at a dose of 2.4 million units was non-inferior to 3 treatments with benzathine penicillin G administered a week apart for a total of 7.2 million units. Editorialists Lindley Barbie and Laura Bachman from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, write that the findings from the trial by Hook and co-authors should provide reassurance to clinicians, particularly those caring for patients with HIV infection, that a single dose of benzathine penicillin G is sufficient to treat early syphilis. The question remains as to whether persons with late latent syphilis or syphilis of unknown duration should receive the CDC-recommended regimen of 3 2.4 million unit doses of benzathine penicillin G. The data supporting the CDC recommendation are theoretical. In addition to studies evaluating the need for 3 doses of benzathine penicillin G for late latent syphilis and syphilis of unknown duration, studies of new non-penicillin drugs for the treatment of the disease are needed. Nearly 100 years into the antibiotic era, an era heralded by the groundbreaking drug penicillin, syphilis continues to plague us. Although many people have forgotten about syphilis, its recent resurgence calls for renewed efforts to advance the diagnostics and therapeutics associated with this age-old infection so that we may finally control it. Monoclonal antibodies in the pathogenesis of heparin-induced thrombocytopenia by Jared Treverton from McMaster University, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and co-authors. Heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, HIT, is an immune-mediated platelet disorder caused by antibodies that target complexes of platelet factor 4, PF4, and heparin. HIT has been characterized as a polyclonal immune response. However, studies of other rare anti-PF4 disorders have identified clonally restricted antibodies. This study investigated the clonality of pathogenic HIT antibodies using serum samples obtained from 9 patients with clinically and serologically confirmed HIT. The pathogenic antibodies in all 9 patients with HIT were found to be monoclonal. This finding challenges previous views of HIT as a polyclonal disorder and suggests new avenues for diagnosis and treatment.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot, and the goal is simple. To help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers, so they in turn can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Management of acute type B aortic dissection. A review article by Firas Musa from UT Health Houston and Panos Kouyas from the State University of New York Downstate Health Sciences University. Aortic dissection is a catastrophic event that affects approximately 13,000 persons each year in the United States. Key risk factors for aortic dissection are hypertension and known genetic aortopathy. Most patients with a type B aortic dissection, in which the origin of the aortic entry tear is distal to the left subclavian artery, are initially treated with medications to reduce blood pressure and myocardial contractility. Surgical or endovascular therapy is reserved for complications, such as aortic rupture or end organ malperfusion. Serial imaging and lifelong surveillance are recommended for all patients who have had an aortic dissection. This review describes the current state of the evidence informing clinical practice for the treatment of type B aortic dissection, as well as areas of controversy and future directions. A Fruitful Workup, a Clinical Problem Solving by Naveen Jain from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and co-authors. A 37-year-old woman presented with a 4-day history of acute pain, swelling, and bruising in her left knee after using an electronic massage gun. She was on lifelong rivaroxaban for prior unprovoked pulmonary embolism and paradoxical embolic stroke, associated with heterozygous factor V Leiden and a patent foramen ovale. Despite no recent trauma beside massage gun use and chronic menorrhagia, she developed worsening anemia, exertional dyspnea, and signs of pulmonary hypertension. Extensive workup, including GI endoscopy and hematologic evaluation, failed to identify a bleeding source. Imaging showed right heart strain, and echocardiography revealed a right-to-left shunt. Closer dermatologic inspection revealed perifollicular hemorrhages, corkscrew hairs, and gingival hypertrophy. Her vitamin C level was undetectable. A diagnosis of scurvy, vitamin C deficiency, was made. She had avoided citrus due to past allergic reactions. Empiric ascorbic acid supplementation led to rapid hematologic and cardiopulmonary recovery, confirming the diagnosis. This case illustrates a rare but severe modern presentation of scurvy mimicking complex hematologic and cardiopulmonary disease. The corporatization deal, healthcare, investors, and the profit priority. A perspective by Amitabh Chandra from Harvard University and Mark Shepard from the National Bureau of Economic Research, Cambridge, Massachusetts. The healthcare industry is exceptional in the United States. It relies on private businesses operating in markets to fulfill a fundamental human need. Because of healthcare's essential nature, many observers have viewed the growing influence of large companies in the industry, known as corporatization, as odious, akin to privatization of fire and police departments. The corporatization of healthcare often evokes images of rapacious companies that prioritize profits over patients, since corporations operate according to the logic of business, emphasizing efficiency and financial returns, whereas medical institutions have traditionally operated as professional or charitable enterprises. Although some critics yearn for a return to a purely professional ethos in healthcare, such a reversal is impractical and potentially irresponsible. Corporatization tends to arise in circumstances in which patients demand cheaper or higher quality care, and large organizations can support those aims by taking advantage of economies of scale, in which the cost of each additional unit, such as a hospitalization or dose of medicine, is lower than the cost of the previous one. Evaluating corporatization requires understanding why it occurs, when it can succeed, and why it can go wrong. The key question for society is whether corporatization benefits patients and payers. Advancing physician-scientist training in China: challenges, gaps, and future directions. A perspective by Pei Li and co-authors. Clinical science, which integrates research with patient care, is vital for advancing medicine and improving health outcomes. Yet global factors, such as declining interest in research among medical professionals and limited training opportunities, are threatening the translation of scientific discoveries into clinical practice. Numbers of physician scientists are declining worldwide amid systemic pressures such as instability of funding streams, prioritization of clinical workloads over research, and fragmented training pathways. Some of these trends jeopardize clinical science in high-income countries, as exemplified by recent cuts to U.S. federal research budgets, while low- and middle-income countries face compounded challenges, including resource constraints and underdeveloped research infrastructure. China's evolving physician-scientist training landscape serves as a critical case study, reflecting both global barriers and scalable strategies for harmonizing clinical care and research innovation. Despite China's status as the second largest contributor to biomedical publications, clinician-led studies are underrepresented in this output, and clinical research training opportunities are limited. There is thus an urgent need to evaluate and reform physician-scientist training in China to enhance interest and improve programs that can cultivate a robust pipeline of research leaders and advance clinical science. The rise of drug innovation in China. Implications for patient access in the United States and globally. A perspective by Kerstin Folkinger from the Ida Genussische Technische Hochschule, Zurich, Switzerland. Trade-related tensions between the United States and China have escalated dramatically in recent months. Despite a tentative agreement in May 2025, extended in August 2025, to reduce the size of newly imposed tariffs on both sides, geopolitical frictions remain. Among other implications, these tensions threaten the cross-border trade of medicines. In recent years, China has emerged as an important player in new drug development, a field traditionally dominated by the United States and European countries. The rise of Chinese pharmaceutical innovation is reflected in the number of new drugs that were approved in China before being approved in any other country, which increased from 9 in 2018 to 45, not including three traditional Chinese medicines, in 2024. Of the 45 new drugs first approved in China last year, 40 were developed by Chinese manufacturers. More than 10 Chinese-made drugs have been approved in the United States and Europe since 2019. Furthermore, several Chinese-made drugs have been first-in-class medicines or have been shown to have important added therapeutic benefits as compared with other existing treatments. China's growing role in pharmaceutical innovation has implications for global access to promising new medicines and presents challenges for U.S. regulators and policymakers. Our images in clinical medicine show the Popeye sign in transthyretin amyloidosis. A 75-year-old man presented with a 3-week history of fatigue and palpitations. Bulging of the biceps during elbow flexion was noted. ECG showed low-voltage QRS complexes, and echocardiography showed left ventricular hypertrophy. In another image, radiation pneumonitis is shown. A 54-year-old woman with infiltrating ductal carcinoma of the right breast, treated with locoregional radiation, presented with cough, fever, and dyspnea. CT showed fibrotic and ground glass opacities in the irradiated area. A third image shows the Hutchinson sign in subungual melanoma in situ. A 71-year-old man presented with a 2-year history of a darkening line on his left thumbnail. Also noted were a brown discoloration of the left thumbnail and hyperpigmentation of the proximal nail fold and tip of the thumb. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.